Let's move on to paper 1G, which comes in four parts. This is the first four substantive sets of deliberations by this committee about the revision of the due process handbook. We will continue this in January with some additional matters. That's covered actually in the next paper, paper 1H. But let's return to 1G, which discusses adding projects to the board's work plan, the role of effects analysis in the due process handbook, the treatment of the taxonomy in the due process handbook, and anonymous complaints. Henry, I think you're going to do the work plan.
Yes. Should we start with the 1G1, which is the paper on agenda decisions and supporting consistent application?
There are five items.
Yeah. So if we start with 1G1, we'll do them in order. So this paper proposes giving the board a new tool, if you like, to support consistent application of the standards. And that tool would be equivalent to an agenda decision that's currently available only to the Interpretations Committee. So why are we proposing this? Well, in a nutshell, there are occasions when the board, and it's not frequent, but when the board actually deals with implementation questions rather than going through the Interpretations Committee. And that's most commonly, actually, it's when we get questions on new standards when no practice has yet appeared. So the board is in a better position to deal with the implementation question. So that could be a matter referred from the Transition Resource Group. And when the board considers the question that's arisen, it may conclude that no standard setting is required, but it still wants to provide some explanatory information to stakeholders to reinforce how the requirements should be applied. Now, the Interpretations Committee, when it's in a similar position, it can do that via the agenda decision. And you'll recall at the last meeting, we walked you through the agenda decisions and that process. And you'll remember that agenda decisions don't have the status of the standard, and they can't change the standards or add new requirements in the standard, but critically, they can provide really helpful information to explain how the principles and requirements of the standard should apply. But the point is, the board doesn't have an equivalent tool. And effectively, for the board to do anything with any formality, it actually has to really do standard setting. So when the board concludes the standard setting is not appropriate, it actually has to use less persuasive tools than the Interpretations Committee, and it has to use tools such as webcast and the like. So this paper is sort of saying, we think the board should have at its disposal an equivalent tool to the Interpretations Committee's agenda decision, subject to the same thorough due process, so that it also can publish helpful and persuasive information to stakeholders to support consistent application of the standards. And the paper highlights a couple of instances of recent cases where we think it would have been helpful had the board had such a tool. Now, one of the things we've learned from talking to some people about this, it's really important to emphasize this is not in any way about changing existing processes for the committee. This is about giving the board an additional tool. And furthermore, so most implementation questions will continue to go to the Interpretations Committee. No change to how stakeholders will submit questions. And furthermore, we don't expect the board to be issuing agenda decisions routinely. It would be very much by exception. And just in those cases when the board thinks it would be helpful to get something out there to support consistent application. The other point the paper highlights is a terminological point. As you know from June, actually the handbook calls agenda decisions rejection notices. We've stopped calling them that because it's not good communication at all, because agenda decisions are helpful. So we're sort of saying today, proposing obviously that terminology should go. But in actual fact, the discussions we've had have highlighted that agenda decision is also not a desperately good name, and maybe we could still do better in terms of communicating what they contain. And so that's something that we'll think further on as we sort of draft up this requirement subject to your approval today. So So that's all I want to say about the paper, but just to give you a little bit of explanation about why we think it is necessary for the board to have this additional tool.
I was at the advisory committee meeting where this was discussed, and the 2 points that the advisory committee raised, as the paper reports, the advisory committee was in favor of this change. They had there were a significant number of advisory committee members who had reservations about it, and they focused around the 2 points that Henry raised, which are, as he stated, no one wants to see the board issuing agenda decisions every week or every month. And secondly, the concern that this would somehow interfere with the work of the interpretations committee. I was actually going to correct one thing Henry said, which he said essentially every interpretation issue would still go to the interpretations committee. Every interpretations question will still go to the interpretations committee. That process will not change at all. This is really to provide an alternative process when issues get to the board, very occasionally from the interpretations committee, but more likely, rarely, but more likely from stakeholders who raise things like implementation issues that come out of a TRG or other feedback. I gather that the feedback away from the advisory committee has been essentially on the same issues. So, Larry?
Thank you, Alan. So, very supportive, but it's not so much a but as an additional point of why is the interpretations committee agenda decisions not authoritative? And similarly, any new tool of the board, why would it not be authoritative, which is incredibly important from a consistency point of view, an auditor's ability to insist on a company to comply, and also, as I understand it, in practice, it raises issues when there is an accounting change. You know, is it retrospective? Is it a correction of an error, et cetera? And maybe there's a history here that I'm not aware of, but why would the interpretations committee not be similar to the EITF, where the EITF comes up with a position, it's sent to the board. If the board does not object, it is considered authoritative, so that companies need to comply.
That is, in fact, Larry, an issue that is currently with the Standards Board in the context of the proposals around, so it's IAS 8 is the, there's a exposure draft out, there's a comment period, comment was received that included the question of whether agenda decisions should be authoritative. The board is taking that up at its December meeting, I think, or November. In any event, has not yet taken it up, has not yet concluded, and this is another of those cases where it's kind of premature for the Due Process Oversight Committee to try to decide or It's premature for the Due Process Oversight Committee to think about whether either committee agenda decisions, for the purposes of the Due Process Handbook, what should be said about whether they're authoritative or not depends on where the board comes out, and we don't know that yet. So I think the answer to your question is stay tuned.
Maybe I could just...
But it's a good question.
Maybe I could also just add that, but I mean, we're careful not to say, we don't say they're not authoritative, because these agenda decisions do have due process. So you know, the market takes them very seriously, but what we say is they don't have the status of IFRS standards. And when you look at the material in an agenda decision, you know, the committee has to be very careful to ensure that that material doesn't add to any of the requirements of the standard or change the requirements of the standard. And what good agenda decisions do is they are really a guide to how you work your way through the requirements to answer the particular question. And to me, you know, what's been really good about some of the ones we've done recently, and I'm thinking about IFRS 15, which is a standard very close to me, but I think what they did a really good job was that question comes in, it's a good question, and the agenda decision is actually repeating the very specific relevant bits of the standard, drawing on any relevant bits from the illustrative examples that accompany that standard, and crucially, rationale from the basis for conclusion. So it's really joining all of the dots in the requirements. And to me, personally, it would be strange to say that is IFRS standards, because in actual fact, what it's doing is repeating a lot of the material that already exists in our standards. And I think maintaining the idea that you have a principle-based set of standards and then you provide the appropriate supporting guidance, I think, is important. But as Alan says, we have had some feedback on this question on the exposure draft the board issued earlier this year. So this is something that the board will consider and will be reporting back to you more fully on this question early next year.
Other questions on?
I would be pretty supportive in changing the agenda decision name tag, because I think it doesn't reflect well what it's doing. But I have a question. I don't have any trouble in giving this extra tool to the board. But I was just wondering, and it's because maybe I don't know the process well enough. By doing this, is there any instance in which we could be putting into conflict a view of the committee with a view of the board, and then giving this extra tool to the board would actually create that conflict, or that's something that could not happen?
I think the primary purpose here is for when the board is dealing with a question that actually didn't go through the committee's process. So, for example, a question coming out of a TRG discussion, or indeed that we just become aware of an emerging issue on a new standard, and the board considers that question, the board would then, you know, if they thought it was appropriate, they would have the mechanism to propose an agenda decision, expose it for public comment, and then finalise it. So, if you like, it's not setting up a conflict with the Interpretations Committee.
I actually think, Dr. Lerma, one of the reasons why we're keen to have this process is to avoid conflicts between the board and the Interpretations Committee, because at the moment, because the board doesn't have a tool other than doing formal standard setting to opine, if you like, on a particular matter, we need to try and get the committee to do it. And so we've got into situations where the committee looks at something, they give us feedback, the board says, no, what about this? It goes back to the committee. We've had ping-ponging, which creates potential conflicts but also timing delays. So I think we actually hope to be able to reduce any potential friction between the committee and the board by establishing this mechanism that we could use for unusual things.
And in that sense, would it make sense and maybe this doesn't make sense, but would it make sense that for the board to actually use this, to have the agreement of the committee, or doesn't have to be the case?
What I think we could look at, we need to think about it more, is the point that Alan raised earlier, which was what we're proposing is that all questions would still come in through the normal route, and then it might either go to the committee or to the board. What we could perhaps do is think about a step where, if it's not coming to the committee, that there's at least a report to the committee or something that gives them the opportunity to comment on its way to the board or some.
Just to make sure that a conflicting view between the committee and the board would not come up. That would be my only concern.
There's one other
there's one other point that I think makes it essentially impossible, which is committee agenda decisions do go to the board before they're published. So,
The board is made. The board gets an update.
I didn't say they approve it. But they are exposed to the board. This is not. We don't have a situation of the committee acting in a vacuum, and then the board unknowingly or intentionally doing something else. There also are members of the board on the committee. I mean, there's a healthy overlap here. I don't think there's a. I think it's a practical impossibility here. Teresa.
Thank you. I'm also giving more to the board, and I think the sort of overriding objective is to help with to support the consistent application of IFRS standards. So I'm absolutely all for it. I was interested to hear that there was a significant minority disagreeing at the advisory council, and I was just wondering, you know, what those objections were, and I do worry about this overlapping membership and the status of both, although the paper does say that they are of equal validity, as it were, but then will there be a situation where somehow it went to the board, but the interpretation committee does not actually agree with it? Then what happens?
My recollection in terms of the pockets of disagreement at the committee, I think one of the pockets came from a concern that it might be the case that what we were thinking of doing was every month when we have a board meeting would be issuing agenda decisions, and so suddenly there'd be a huge volume of agenda decisions coming from the committee as well as from the board. So I think we've done some work to address that concern in the way that we've tried to express when we would use it, and we need to keep working on that. So I think that was one potential area. I think also one of the reasons why we had some negative feedback from some committee members was there was a misunderstanding from some committee members that in effect we could already do a sort of process of making changes to the standards post-publication anyhow, and so we did need this mechanism, which is not actually the case. So there was an element of misunderstanding, and also just I think we didn't do a fantastic job in terms of communicating how we thought we would use it. And so I think it was helpful for me in raising some good points to clarify and sort of hone our thinking, and I would hope that if we took it back to the committee today, to the council today, there'd probably be at least some of the voices who would probably not object who did before. Some of it was also, though, to be complete, Larry's point about the level of authority of the decisions was raised as well. So it wasn't per se about the board having a tool, it was more the more general question about the authority of any agenda decision.
And on the conflict point, would there be a situation where there is an agenda decision, and because it went to you directly, it didn't go to the interpretations committee, you know, they do not agree with it, and I don't know what the process would be if that were the case, particularly if there are overlapping members.
I mean, I would think that if the question went to the board, then the board would deal with it, and I'd be concerned about sort of over processing this, because I think that could affect the timeliness. But I think one thing that, you know, this discussion has raised and other discussions have highlighted as well is the importance of the transparency about questions coming, if you like, into the postbox or the website, effectively where they go, and have very clear transparency around that, so that people don't feel that something got lost or something was diverted for some particular reason. So I think that's something that we'll have to ensure that we have those.
Or usurping the authority or the kind of mandate of the interpretations committee. I think that's something that one needs to.
And that was definitely a point coming from the council to you know, wanted assurance that this wasn't about sort of taking authority away from the committee at all, which it isn't.
Michelle?
Yeah, my comments were very much along the same line, and when I read the proposal. I think the risk I would see would be to undermine basically the committee. And one way to do that could be to address that could be to actually make sure that the board cannot take such a decision without being. I mean, all the questions are to the committee, and then some of those are elevated to the board. But if you have two sets of bodies that can actually, you know, take on a question, I think that creates ambiguity and actually could undermine the interpretation committee. So, I mean, I would, you know, try to think about what can we do to give more empowerment to the interpretation committee and increase the sort of connectivity between both of the, you know, the committee and the board as sort of a important objective in, you know, in looking at those questions, basically.
Understood. Else, do you have your card up? Okay. Yeah. Okay, I think I'd like to call the question again. Does the committee agree that the due process handbook should be amended to permit, under the circumstances that we've been describing, and you'll see the drafting where we are trying to deal with some of the implementation issues around transparency and lack of confusion and overlap, but as a conceptual matter, does the committee agree that the possibility of board agenda decisions should be added to the due process handbook? Any no's? Okay, excellent. Thank you very much. Let's go on to the adding projects to the board's work plan, which is paper G2. Henry?
Thank you, Alan. So this paper is proposing some refinements to the handbook about the consultation required before the board adds projects to its work plan. So why are we making this proposal? Well, currently the due process handbook specifies that the board should consult the Advisory Council, ASAF, and the wider national standard-setting community before adding major projects to the standard-setting part of its work plan. However, in practice, this requirement creates actually somewhat of a rigid rule, perhaps, and it can, in some situations, result in consultation that actually seems inconsistent with its objective of providing input to the board about its agenda prioritization. And a good recent example of this was the primary financial statement project that I mentioned a moment ago in the technical update project, because the board's been working on this project, I think, since about 2014, and it's featured as one of the projects in the board's agenda consultation that they undertook, public agenda consultation, in 2015-2016. And so recently the board wanted to address the question about whether to move that project from the research program to the standard setting program. So it was required to consult the Advisory Council and ASAF. But the point is that all of those stakeholders have been consulted as part of the most recent agenda consultation on the question about whether primary financial statements is an area on which the board, you know, priority area on which the board should be allocating some of its resources. And furthermore, in the consultation document that we're planning to issue next year, we will obtain input on the board's assessment that standard setting is required and is feasible to address the problems in financial reporting. So we actually think in this case, consultation with ASAF and the Advisory Council just seems unnecessary and actually potentially causes some impediments to project efficiency. But it's only in some cases we think this consultation required by the handbook is inappropriate, because if you think of another recent example, which was the management commentary project, the consultation there that we undertook with those bodies does seem appropriate, because there we were considering adding a project to the work plan on which we hadn't got any feedback in the agenda consultation about whether that's an area we should be working on. So it seems appropriate in those situations. So that's why we propose in paragraph 25 of the paper really to refine the requirement of consulting before adding major projects to the work plan to focus on add, you know, the requirement to consult is before adding a major project to the work plan, regardless of whether that's to the research program or to the standard setting program, when that project hasn't been contemplated in an agenda consultation. We think that's where we need feedback on the question of agenda prioritization. And we're also proposing just a narrow refinement to the requirement to consult to just focus on the Advisory Council and the ASAF, our two main sort of strategic and technical bodies, and remove the reference to the accounting standard setting bodies, because we think that's actually not formally necessary now, given ASAF is functioning well and effectively is our mechanism of getting feedback from the wider national standard setters community because of the representation of the regional groups on ASAF.
Thank you, Henry. The only point I would make, this really is a narrow scope amendment, to coin a phrase, to deal with what I almost think is an inadvertent glitch in the current version of the handbook, which is 5.6 requires this consultation on the issue of something being added to the work program that wasn't approved for the work program in a prior agenda consultation, one of the periodic consultations on the board's overall program. And that's both under-inclusive and over-inclusive. It's under-inclusive in the sense that things can be added to the research program, including very substantial things, without triggering, that weren't contemplated in the agenda consultation, without going through 5.6, because they're not mentioned. And moving something to the work program, which was fully debated as part of the agenda consultation when it was put on the research program, which contemplates that things go through the research program, and if a need is found, then going to the work program, that seems over-inclusive. And so the thought would be, in effect, at the right time, which is when the board is first deciding whether to make something a call on its resources and a priority, let's do this consultation, but let's not do it at an arbitrary later time also and hold things up. And the second thing is really just very technical. I think the board has now come to rely on the ASAF as its mechanism for consulting national standard setters, and this would be a change that recognized that. So that's what we're about here, I think. Comments, questions? If not, I'd ask whether the committee agrees with these changes. Any disagreement? Okay, I'll take that as agreement. Let's move on to, in a few minutes, effects analysis, which I'm going to ask Richard to.
Good morning, everybody. Effects analysis, this is something that the board has been committed to for a number of years, and we set out how that has developed in the paper. The objective of this paper today is to ask you about the direction of travel that we, the things that we think need to be amended in the handbook, which are relatively minor, so that we can produce those for you to the next meeting. In particular, in paragraphs 11 and 12, we set out the issues that the Advisory Council put to us in February this year. They've asked us to four issues that are set out there. And in particular, they advise the board to be more explicit about how it analyzes the potential effects of standards at an early stage of development, saying in Appendix B. The process of using effects analysis is continuing to develop. We think that the handbook could be amended to reflect that better, to reflect the developments in how it's being used, specifically the advice that we got from the effects analysis consultative group, which is now completely embedded in what we do, and the feedback from the Advisory Council. We don't think this would require major changes to the handbook, but we thought we would get your views on whether this is the right direction to go in before we start the drafting for the next meeting.
I think the paper is pretty self-explanatory. I would point out only one. That is the advisory council. If you look at 11, advisory council recommended that effects analysis should continue to focus primarily on the effects of financial statements. This, I think, is an allusion to the age-old debate about the effects of financial statements on other kinds of activities like bank regulatory, capital levels, so on and so forth. And the advisory council, I was not at this meeting, but I've heard pretty clear reports about it. One of the things that that group, and I think the board, I don't think I'm putting words in the board's mouth, the board feels pretty strongly about is that when we talk about effects analysis, we talk about the effects on the financial statements and not on ancillary items. And that is one of the directions that we're being asked to go in, and I thought I would explicitly flag it because it is, as I say, it was the one thing in the paper that struck me as being not necessarily intuitively obvious.
Yeah, I'm in agreement with the proposal here, but I would like to stress that I think that the recommendations of the effects analysis consultative group are really strong, and to the extent that they could be reflected in the due process handbook, I would be all for it.
That is part of the plan. Absolutely.
I mean, the what Alan just mentioned, the fact that the effects analysis should be centered on the effect of the financial statements and not necessarily around all the other subjects that some people try to.
I always find it very difficult to argue when people ask us what is the effect of your standard to financial stability, for example, IFRS 17, and then to answer that's none of our business. We just look at the financial statements. That just doesn't fly. And also it's not true because my line of defense has always been good, transparent financial information is an essential ingredient for financial stability. And I have come up with lots of arguments why IFRS 17 is very important for financial stability because it gives a much better portrayal of the actual performance of an insurance company. So I have personally absolutely no problem with this sort of requirement because for both IFRS 9 and IFRS 17, we are IFRS 16 leases. We were very much capable of introducing of defending, and not even defending, but explaining positively how we contribute to financial stability. So let's not be defensive about this. And the argument, yeah, we only look at the financial statement, that nobody understands that. So I don't know exactly how this is going to be written down, but I would not be defensive about it.
Thank you, Hans.
I agree with Hans, and I think that's why Richard's probably been quite careful with his choice of words in 11C, because I think we're saying the main focus should be on the effect of financial statements, but of course, where there are other effects, we'll talk about it as well. And so I think it's a bit tricky how we'll draft that, but to Hans's point, I think we do think about, you know, consequences of beyond the pure financial statements, and we need to capture that somehow. I think the other thing we're going to have to be a little bit careful of when we come back and look at the drafting, flagging this for you, Richard, is that I think sometimes when people talk about effects analysis, they mean different things. And so I see we use effects analysis, little e, little a, which I think means, to me, I say analysis of effects.
So we're always thinking about what's the effect of things we're doing. And every board paper we have, you know, to some extent thinks about the effects that we're doing. But then at the end of a big project like IFRS 17, we do this big glossy book that we spend hundreds of hours putting together, which is the formal capital E, capital A effects analysis. And I think we need to be careful not to send inadvertently a message that we're going to be doing these big glossy, time-consuming books for every tiny little project that we do. But we're always going to be thinking about
right.
the analysis of effects
right.
in a proportionate manner.
Right.
And we need somehow to be very clear to distinguish those two pieces of work
right.
in whatever we draft.
Right. That's absolutely right. And I think the paper, the scalable, proportionate, yeah, exactly. Yeah. Right. No, I think we have to be very careful about that, but that certainly is the objective. Michelle? Prada?
No, just to echo what Hans said, because it appears that we cannot deny the fact that sometimes we are, in brackets, the scapegoats of difficulties or disputes that are not really directly linked to what we do. And we cannot neglect this, and it makes sense for us to respond and clarify. You mentioned the volatility or financial stability. You could mention long-term, which is the new mantra today. Accounting standards prevent from long-term investment. Well, I don't know if that is the case, but if it is the case, I'm very surprised that our U.S. friends have so many long-term commitments and strategies with standards that are not very different from our standards philosophically. So we probably need to respond and to take this on board.
IFRS 17 is also a good... Or insurance accounting is a very good example of how poor accounting can lead to very negative behavioral effects. For example, in current accounting for most insurance companies, they are very much able to average between generations of contracts, the earnings. And they can even keep on recognizing earnings of contracts that have already expired. Probably not in Canada, which is on a current basis, but especially the companies that work with historical cost accounting. That's why it also makes me so mad, the people who think that historical cost accounting is safer than fair value accounting. But that means that even if a company's performance is deteriorating, they can still use the profits from the earlier years to keep the earnings steady, to keep dividend distribution steady, to keep remuneration steady. That's why a lot of these managers get very emotional about accounting, even though the company is doing much worse than 3 years ago. So, you know, for us to ignore these things is stupid. And because we always try to improve accounting, in most cases, unless we make unforeseen mistakes, it does lead to better financial stability, and it does lead to less possibilities of doing funny stuff with the accounts and have all sorts of these negative behavioral consequences. So I think we need to reword a little bit how we're going to put this, because we have to use these things for a positive benefit instead of trying to push it away from us.
Thank you, Hans. Michelle?
No, I fully agree with what Hans said and Michelle and others. I think at the same time, this is a daunting task, really, to if you think about trying to measure all the impact that, you know, a set of and standards may have. And my question would be, how can you sort of, you know, when you say we'll look at the impact or the effect on financial reporting, you have, you know, you set the box. And when you think about more broadly, that's very wide. And so I think the challenge would be to, you know, define that in a way that you don't appear to be, on one end, you know, ignorant of all the implication of what you're doing, but at the same time, not, you know, ineffective in assessing this impact. And there is clearly a resource element into that. There are many dimensions around that. And, you know, obviously a lot of thinking needs to be put against that. But, you know, just striking a balance, and the risk you run is basically that you're going to disappoint everyone because you're going to set expectations about an effect analysis that will be much wider than what you're able to do. And maybe I'm wondering, almost that shouldn't be separate from, you know, what there could be an effect analysis that is really on financial reporting, but also a more broader sort of, you know, impact analysis that could be somehow disconnected. I don't know if that's a way to.
Raj?
I was wondering if one could be so bold as to think about dropping the effect analysis and then waiting until you do the post-implementation review. And if that's unthinkable, how have we compared what we've said in terms of effects analysis with subsequent post-implementation review to compare how accurate we've been in our forecast? If we have been inaccurate, maybe we should stop forecasting and wait till afterwards.
Okay.
One question, this very interesting question, what is effects analysis? And as Michelle said, what is impact assessment? The impact assessment is now established methodology by OECD and all the others, which it's almost obligatory to make any proposal to change legislation. What is the difference between effects analysis and impact assessment? I'd like to just to know, because if you go to deep impact assessment, then it's more impact assessment. That's one issue. Second is then, of course, the question whether you had just focused on the statements or on broader impact of the science.
I'm actually in violent agreement with Hans and with Erki. I think I absolutely agree we should be aggressive and in stating our point of view and why we think the standards that the board adopts are good for long-termism, are good for accurate measurement for reasons of all sorts of policy points of view. What I think we don't want to do, and what I took the effects analysis statement as meaning is our effects analysis should not include a discussion of the impact on bank regulatory capital. But it definitely is not a restriction on doing the kinds of things that Hans is correctly pointing out are very important to us and our brand, and we shouldn't be defensive about them. So, other comments? This has been a lively and interesting debate.
Just a brief comment on Erki's question, because I'm not sure, I'm not a bit confused. It's clear for me that effect analysis is ex ante,
yes,
and we try to identify the possible consequences of a change, and we recognize that this is extremely difficult to do because there are a host of data which are not necessarily available and models that are not necessarily available, and therefore we try to do it, but we're not really sure of the outcome because it's a sort of a predictive approach. Impact assessment takes place a couple of years later, and here we are looking at the facts and see whether we can identify the consequences of the change, which is not necessarily easy either, because the consequences of the change could come from the standard, but they could also come from other reasons, other phenomena which would have impacted the evolution. But this is fairly clear for me, and
And I think that when you mention OECD, they have a vision of impact assessment, which is more effect analysis than it. Is the concept the same? I'm not sure.
I just put the question because this impact assessment is an established issue now. It's like state of art. If I understand right, this effects analysis is more limited. More limited is something where they do, for instance, economic modeling and try to have even quantitative impacts of decisions, but it's mainly on economy, but sometimes also on social and environmental. It comes closer to this kind of reporting challenge which we have. So I just, that effects analysis can be right, but it's good to be clear with the terms, because people have in their minds impact assessment nowadays. Effects analysis is more limited.
One of the things this conversation demonstrates to me is it strengthens
my view that we need to address this, make what we mean by effects analysis more precise in the handbook. I think what that exactly is going to be will be something we work out as we draft and think, but the question for the committee today, I think, is do we tackle this particular set of amendments and try to create a better definition of effects analysis and a more precise description of the manner in which it would be used for different projects. Anyone disagree?
So you're rephrasing the question, basically, that is asked.
What I'm actually doing is, all I'm really trying to do is say that we've heard enough in this discussion to know that this paper doesn't set out a specific definition of effects analysis. So in that sense, I'm not asking us to do anything different from what the paper is doing. What I'm saying is this discussion has made it clearer, A, that there's a need for a better definition in our handbook, and two, that we probably are less far along in deciding what that definition would be than we thought we were when we wrote the paper.
Right, but as stated, it says, do we agree with the amendments? And your point is that we don't agree with amendments. We agree that...
Yeah, but we're going to do the amendments. I think the amendments are not inconsistent in any way with what's in here,
okay. But
I think where we are going is less certain.
We haven't actually proposed any amendments at this stage. We've simply asked whether you're agreeing with the direction of travel.
Okay.
So there are no... Giving some proposed amendments.
A very last remark, if I may. Do I understand well that we have three concepts, really? One is effect analysis, the other one is impact assessment, and the other one is post-implementation review.
Yes.
And then we have to clarify which is which and what is the scope when it takes place. We don't do impact assessment, but in a way what you said would lead to make it.
Well, no, because it is totally impossible to make economic impact assessments on such on changes in accounting standards. What you can only do is give qualitative remarks about it, which way you think it will work.
Okay.
I would feel that we need to be very clear in our objectives, because we shouldn't be becoming too aspirational or becoming too ambitious about what we are setting out to achieve, because then the stakeholders, whoever are the ones who will be looking at them, will start looking at them from a certain standpoint, and that's the standpoint which we are not going to be addressing. So I have a feeling that, you know, we might create body of knowledge which will be insufficient from what I expect it to be. So unless we lay out very clearly what our definitions are going to be and how limited effects analysis is going to be vis-a-vis impact, we'll be running short of aspirations that we. So I think we need to redraft this thing.
I think the hard work here will be to draft what we want. I don't think we can get there today because we don't have words on a page.
Yeah, so we lay out the objectives in very well, clearly, concisely defined manner and then address them.
Pages 6 and 7 set out the recommendations we had from the effects analysis consultative group. So that was a public process. And I don't think this discussion has taken us a million miles away from that. So the framework is there. It's a question of getting the language clear in the handbook so that it's future-proofed. But I think most of the work is there on the big picture.
Conclusion will have to be different from what is written out in this, in terms of his decisions.
We're asking at this stage that you agree with the direction of travel, which is that we seek to incorporate the advice we've had from the Advisory Council and the Effects Analysis Consultative Group more closely in the handbook. And in that process, we will have regard to the discussions we've had here about being clear about definitions and scope.
I'm still a bit confused, to be honest. Firstly, I would rather have a resolution that's sort of put on the table, too.
But I think what we're asking, if you just want to say the staff go off and the committee takes it right, we'll talk about it when you are gone. I would rather
pick up the objectives of the advisory committee and the effects analysis consultative group, agree that... have the committee agree in principle with them, take into account the discussion we've had here today, and then go forward with the paper that you will then get to see. Okay? Okay. Do we have any disagreement with that? No, good. Okay. Richard, the next one?
Yep. The IFS taxonomy. You'll be aware that the IFX taxonomy elements of the due process handbook are included in an annex to the handbook, but the links between the two are not terribly strong. In particular, there are no specific or very few specific points where the Due Process Oversight Committee is required to review what we do on them, on taxonomy. The staff recommendations are in starting paragraph 4. Just to be aware that in paragraph 4, the third sentence, these do not require board or other approval, but are subject to review by the Taxonomy Review Panel and optionally by the ITCG. Optionally is incorrect. There is a requirement for the ITCG to review. That was a drafting error. So what we're setting out here is the proposal that the paragraphs in the due process handbook could be supported by the inclusion of a table, which we've provided for you there, and that the specific role for the DPOC in overseeing due process around the taxonomy could be made more explicit. We've set out for you what is currently done, but we think some more explicit control points would be helpful. And the questions that we've set to you, do you agree that we should amend the handbook to clarify the approval and review process to specify more closely the DPOC's oversight of the taxonomy and to include explanatory paragraph that explains how that fits together?
Yeah, the taxonomy section of the handbook is clearly a bolt-on to the original handbook. The taxonomy was developed afterwards. There's no reference in the handbook to the taxonomy, which is included in the annex. This is largely, to my way of thinking, and I guess I was the person who introduced this, I think the committee for its own purposes and protection, frankly, needs a more precise description of what the Due Process Oversight Committee is doing with respect to the taxonomy section of the handbook. And also, if we ever were to receive a complaint about, if we were to receive a complaint tomorrow about something that happened in the development of a taxonomy, I do not know how this committee would handle that complaint under the current edition of the current version of the handbook. And I think we need to do something so that in the event that there were a complaint, there would be a path that we could follow that had a beginning and an end, and that we also had clearer responsibilities for what we were doing in the ordinary course. And so that's what's behind these amendments. I don't know if there are any questions. If not, do we agree with the direction we're taking with this? Does anyone disagree? Terrific. And we're running over, but we have one more. Anonymous complaints.
Yes, anonymous complaints. So you may remember that we had a complaint about due process about this time last year, which was dealt with in accordance with the requirements of the handbook, and as required in the handbook, the outcome was sent to the complainant and published on the website. The challenge here was that complainant chose to remain anonymous, reported to us the pseudonymous email address, and asked not to be named. And I don't know the name, neither does anyone else. We've been considering that at the time the committee expressed some concern about the status of anonymous complainants, whether they should have the same status, whether this was the opportunity for people to make complaints which weren't entirely justified because they could hide behind their anonymity. And we've been thinking about this. We've done quite a lot of work internally comparing this with other whistleblowing requirements. And clearly the two points that are at issue here is first, how due process only works if people are comfortable that they can complain and that those complaints will be addressed, but equally how due process works because it is robust and extremely transparent. Now, we don't want to be in a position where people can't make complaints because they feel that they are conflicted or that someone knowing their status would be a problem for them. But we also want to make sure that people are prepared to stand up and express their concerns. And if someone is completely anonymous, we don't have the opportunity to get further information, to get further clarification of what their concerns are. So we are proposing that we should amend the handbook to make it clear that we would still prefer to have complaints made public, and to encourage complainants who want to have some degree of anonymity to make their name known to the chair of the committee or the director of adjusted activities, but also in circumstances where the committee believe that this is a serious and credible complaint, that they would still be prepared to consider a complaint which is entirely anonymous.
Sheila?
In the document, you talk about an issue that might be sensitive, and I think I'd like you to consider whether those have to be made public. I mean, there could be an allegation that it would be harmful, actually, to put something on the website. I don't know. Suppose there was an allegation that one of the board members was in a conflict of interest or had done something untoward in considering. I don't think those kinds of things should be published on our website. Yet there doesn't seem to be any exception in here.
Nor is there currently.
No, but so I'm just saying I'd like you to think through that because there can be times when there would be allegations that could be actually quite harmful to disclose publicly. Now, I think they have to be dealt with and they would have to be resolved, but you might want to keep them internally rather than...
Right. I mean, among the...
At least until they were resolved. But I think even then, you'd have to think on a case by case, and I would assume it would be really rare that this would ever happen. But I think we just need a provision in there.
I have actually thought a little bit about this issue in a different context, which is, I think it's unlikely that those directly raise due process issues as opposed to other problems. I'm therefore not even sure they come within the purview of this committee, as opposed to trustees and trustee leadership and so forth. But your point is a very well taken one. There may be a situation where, in effect, they overlap, and we should be sure that.
And there may be all kinds of provisions like personal information and stuff that would exclude them anyways. But I just think there needs to be something somewhere.
Very good point. Yeah. Thank you, Sheila. Sorry.
Can I just ask a quick, because I think the wording here is quite important, and I see some differences in the wording of the staff recommendation, where it seems to be that we will consider anonymous complaints if, where the text in the box is more that we will have the discretion to do so. And you could also think about formulating it like we will not take anonymous complaints unless. And if we want to encourage encourage transparency, then the best way may be to say we will not do it unless there is a reason to do so.
Just so we're not talking to each other, you want us to reverse the presumption so that the presumption is we won't take a complaint on if it's anonymous unless there is evidence.
I'm not sure I agree with that. I mean, there have been too many instances in other organizations, and I will not. This organization is definitely not one of them, but I don't want to put us on the wrong foot here. I don't think you disregard complaints because they're anonymous. I don't think you disregard whistleblowers because they're anonymous. And so I think the presumption has to be that you look at them. You may react to them differently. I don't think what we're proposing is inconsistent with that, but I think that the default position is that you start by being open to the validity of the complaint as opposed to putting a barrier up before you consider it.
One point which is between Sheila's and Elsa's point. If anonymous complaint is on a person, it's extremely important to guarantee confidentiality then, with respect to rule of law. I know the cases where this kind of anonymous complaint on a person was leaked out, and his rights of business had disappeared to the right. But I think it's very important to have some paragraph that, you study them all, but of course before you disclose special persons speaks, they respect or stop their rights of defense.
Point well taken, thank you.
I fully agree with this.
Michelle?
I'm rather on the side of Elsa, I have to say, because we're talking about due process, and therefore, we are talking about rather technical issues, and therefore, I don't think we should encourage anonymous complaints regarding due process. And of course, we will receive these anonymous complaints, and we'll look at them. And if they are consistent, significant, worrying, we will look at them. But maybe we should say anonymous complaints will be analyzed only if, because I would not encourage anonymous complaints in this domain, which is a technical domain, really, and there is no reason why you should be anonymous.
I certainly agree we shouldn't encourage anonymous complaints. But if we get one, we should do what we did last time. Well, we're not free to do it if we say the default position is we won't. Maybe what we say is anonymous complaints will be considered by the committee in its discretion. I'm okay with that.
Perhaps we should continue not saying anything rather than having these.
Yeah, at the very least, it would be helpful if complaints were encouraged to tell Alan and me what their names are.
But until we raise this, until the person decided to send it in anonymously, I think that the way that our book read, the expectation would have been that it would have had a name on
it. It is.
And if we turn it around to say our preference is that you say who you are, it implies much more open idea that our anticipation would almost be that.
It's like setting standards for cryptocurrency.
Of likelihood.
Just to encourage that.
I'm just worrying about the messaging, even though I don't.
I think we should. It's better to keep silent because it was very unusual, even stupid, to tell you the truth. There is absolutely no legitimate reason for making an anonymous complaint about due process, given the enormous transparency of our process. So if somebody feels obliged to do it, let's look at it on a case-by-case basis, but I don't think we should make a rule. This is fine-tuning to the extreme.
I think it was the staff that was most concerned about this, and especially Richard's point about...
it was the committee that asked us to look at it.
I was open to...
That's correct.
But having heard this discussion, I just think, let's just stay silent.
I'm a newcomer, but just say that I've been working with these rules of whistleblowing now for the last 10 years. Yeah. And just to know that they exist around. I don't mean they must be applied here, but for instance, we had to do it in ECB. We had to do it in European institutions. Because it happens to be state of art today. But I understand this is a very special institution. But just to know that it exists around. Yeah.
We have whistleblowing.
It's not only here. It's separate there. Okay, fine. Then it's there. Then it's fine. Yeah.
This is about somebody saying you finalised the standard and you should have put it out for comment. That's the type of... It's not very... I find it hard to imagine it being personal.
When I asked the complainant for the name, the complainant said that person was well known to Foundation staff and so would rather not provide the name. Now, if that person had provided the name to me, we wouldn't be having this discussion. If there's been a requirement to tell me, and then I tell Alan but no one else, we wouldn't have a problem.
A sensible way to deal with it in the end, right? So if our conclusion had been that we wanted to propose and we don't, but we wanted to propose that if it was anonymous, we would refuse to deal with it, then I could see why we'd want to put it in here. But really what we've got to is let's assess what's a sensible thing to do if it's anonymous, which is sort of what we did in here.
The committee has been listening to this debate at this end of the table. I guess what I would ask whether it's the current sense of the committee to leave it the way it is. Right? Sorry?
Consider if there could be any circumstances where posting.
Yeah, no, we will. I'm sorry, yes. Separate question. We will do that. Are we in agreement to do nothing for the moment, subject to further reflection? But my view at the moment is we leave it the way it is.
If you do nothing for long enough, it's always the right answer.
Okay. We are really late, so I'm going to
take the next papers, right?